Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, July 19th, 2018 meeting of the General Plan Advisory Committee. We are missing three members today, Rich Bouquet, Melanie Smith, and Glenn Silloway, but we do have a quorum, so we are called to order, and we will start with a moment of silence. And the Pledge of Allegiance. Do we have any GPAC announcements? No? All right. We'll move on to presentations, and we have none of those either. We have nobody waiting in the audience, so we'll move on to the consent calendar, which we don't have, and unfinished business, which we don't have. So we'll move on to new business, Plan Morro Bay status update.
So, all right. God, I can barely read that. I won't get it on here. Okay. So, with the last meeting, we were we reviewed Module 4 and didn't complete it. We have a couple items left in that, and then we're also reviewing the. The zoning code, the remainder of the, or the zoning map for the, yes, I guess, yeah, we haven't rolled the, you haven't seen the zoning map yet, so we'll review that. And where we're at from the status standpoint on the project overall, Plan Morro Bay, is Planning Commission on Tuesday completed review of Module 3. They're scheduled to review Plan Morro Bay, the whole document. You've already seen that, obviously. They're scheduled to start a review of that on the 23rd. No, 7th is the five items on the agenda. Yeah, right? Oh, it's the other way around. Sorry. On August 7th, they'll be Plan Morro Bay, and then moving on into September, they'll probably see Module 4 either in the first or second meeting of September. And that would complete the zoning code portion of it, and they'll be wrapped, and they'll bring all the modules together plus all the changes, and then move forward through for a recommendation and adoption to City Council. They'll do the same thing for Plan Morro Bay. I'll talk a little bit more about meetings and so forth at the end of this. I have that as an item at the end of the agenda to talk about it. Environmental, the EIR is under administrative review right now. It's not entirely complete. Michael Baker International is reviewing it. RINCON is our sub-consultant that's preparing it, and it's sitting with them. I anticipate it being released, at least portions of it, to city staff probably within the next month. And then would be coming out for public consumption maybe in September, October is probably the timeline we're looking at with that. I think that's all I have from the update standpoint.
Do you have any feeling whether any changes being made by the Planning Commission or suggestions or whatever are radically different than the things that we have gone through and talked about? I mean, is it worth us as a board taking a look at anything, just to either argue for or against?
I wouldn't say, radically different. The Planning Commission, because they're our land use authority, I think I would say that they take a little bit deeper of a dive into things. And mostly that's related to the experience that they have in dealing with issues that they see that come up before them. And so I think they have a different eye. They're looking at the codes from a different eye than say, probably most of you, which is a good thing. It's why we had the General Plan Advisory Committee, because we want different eyes on it versus just Planning Commission eyes who are sort of fairly immersed in the development part of things. It's to sort of pick up things that you all see out there in the community to put it into the document. So I wouldn't say there's any dramatic changes. The issue that we're having right now is we're running out of time. The Planning Commission took three meetings to get through Module 3. It's a long time, and we're behind schedule now as a result of that. And so we need to make up some time. And so that's one of the things I was going to talk to you later about a little bit is what are our future meetings for GPAC going to look like? That's a little unclear right now. We have deadlines that we have to meet, and the way things are playing out, if we're not getting through this material in a timely manner, we probably won't be coming back to GPAC unless Council wants to extend the timeline. And we can only extend it so far. And we might be running up against that because our grant deliverables are due in December. Depending on how long it takes the Planning Commission to get through some of this stuff, because they are weighing in a little deeper, we might be right at those deadlines, depending on where we're at. I don't know.
Can we offer them our meeting time?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's also one of the things we're looking at is their ability to add other meetings so we can run some of this, back through you. Again, it's a little bit of a moving target right now because I don't know where we're going to fall. I just know we're behind schedule now as a result of some additional meetings at both GPAC and Planning Commission, really. These things kind of, in many ways, take as long as they take. it's really difficult to rush this. The discussion in the commentary that you have, the discussion you have, is very important to the process. Without that, I don't think we'd be doing the city. I think we'd be doing the city a disservice. So the vetting is the vetting, and so we need to do. We need to go through that and be conscious of how we review the documents. So keeping the eye on the big prize is, though, if we have our grant deliverables and they're due in December, we need to be done then. So at some point, we will have to push if we're not getting there at that point, because we need to be able to send it off to them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we could be facing a situation where we owe $600,000 back. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of at some point, we've got to light the fire and move a little bit so we don't jeopardize that that piece. So,
okay. Anyway.
So Scott, on this EIR, this draft EIR, has that been being worked on all along?
Once we completed the land use, the draft land use alternatives, they started the EIR.
So what does it involve differently than what we've talked about, like sea level rise and I mean, because we some of our things were based on that information. So is this
the EIR makes use of a lot of the background information. I mean, as you're aware, there's a ton of background information for this document,
right.
A couple of thousand pages worth. So it makes use of a lot of that. EIRs are done in a format, and you have to address impacts related to traffic and air quality and biological impacts and all those types of things. There are things that you see, but we have to. Not only do we put it into our general plan underneath various sections that are applicable, we also have to have it in the environmental review because those are potentially significant impacts. And we have to say, we're addressing those so they won't be, and that type of thing. And we're going to probably have in the EIR one statement of overriding consideration, and that relates to traffic. When we do the land use thing and we roll it out and we do it, we have unknowns as it relates to two of large pieces of property in town, maybe a little less unknown now for the water, the wastewater treatment site, but... For Dynegy, the build-out of that property has dramatic traffic impacts, and you have to analyze traffic impacts almost at the maximum development capacity, which would never probably happen, but you still have to do it because it's a conservative analysis. So there's going to be a conversation as it relates to that and what that looks like. The good thing is any project that would go in there would have to do a master plan, and we'll be able to vet what those things are. Otherwise, the EIR just speaks to generalized improvements that can be made in the city, roundabout signalization, road widening, things like that.
Well, then we're just making generalized things too, because like if Dynegy's built out, we don't have any information on the impact, traffic impact, or.
Oh, we do. No, so that's what I'm saying. Once you identified the land uses, like what can go there, it can be commercial, it can be visitor serving. Well, we take the area that's visitor serving and we say, okay, well, maximum density in this area of visitor serving commercial is X. That'll generate this many traffic trips.
Okay.
So we ran a traffic model on the land use scenario that was the preferred land use alternative that went through GPAC, Planning Commission, and ultimately City Council. And so we ran a traffic model on the whole thing, and it identifies minimize the impacts to intersections and what it would be if we built everything out over time. And what that's supposed to do is saying, well, so you don't all of a sudden get to a point where everything's coming to a screeching halt. It says, hey, these are improvements that you have to make over time. And then you put those into a capital improvement program, and those things get built over time, and you put them into your impact fee schedule. And so when projects come forward, they pay their fair share. And that's how you get improvements put into place. There's a lot of stuff that goes into all that. It's very important that we sort of have that analysis done, because it feeds into a lot of things that we do. It also feeds into our budgeting process and goal processes and those types of things once we're done, because we have to have improvements so we don't hit those sort of terrible levels of service that would otherwise happen through a build-out scenario. Again, the city, you're not going to probably ever in Morro Bay build out to 100% of the development capacity. It's probably much less than that. But you have to plan for the worst-case scenario. Okay, are we ready to hit it? So where we left off, we were reviewing the overlay districts and citywide regulations. We made a really, really good headway through that. We only have a couple of items left. This just goes and talks about the different overlays that we have. What did I do with? I think we're in the citywide regulations at this point. I think we got through all of the overlays. So we have hazards and shoreline protection items left, and I didn't think we talked about performance standards last time either, so it would be those two sections. You see the citywide regulations on this slide. Visual resources, affordable housing, coastal hazards, and shoreline protection, which is I think where we're going to start today and where we left off at the last meeting. Landscaping and non-conforming uses, parking and loading, and then the performance standards, which I don't believe we talked about. We skipped around a little bit last time when we were going through it. I think probably because of the way we presented the information, I think we started going headlong into the full presentation, and then GPAC was like, hold on a second, can we talk about some of these things? And in hindsight, we probably should have went item by item. So I would say we're going to pick back up where we left off, and that was the hazards and shoreline protection. That's chapter 17.18.
I want to have one comment on the affordable housing.
Sure.
I was going back. I was rereading it, and the in lieu fees, and I saw that the in lieu fees could only be used on locations within Morro Bay, which seems really reasonable, except. I just have this notion that if we're ever going to do anything really practical about affordable housing, we may have to sort of focus farther afield where property, raw land is less expensive, and maybe it's the cooperation with a bunch of different communities, and we sort of look at what's the reasonable commuting distance and all that. And I was just wondering if we could modify that so the in-lieu fees don't absolutely have to be used within Morro Bay. And I don't want to delay things. It was just a thought of mine. Or is there a prohibition? I guess that's it. Is there a prohibition if sometime in the future we want to combine with the Tascadero and San Luis Obispo and, who knows, Cayucas, and contribute to some site that might be outside the city limits?
The idea behind the concept of the payment of in-lieu fees is that it would offset the requirement by otherwise providing it, and so that would have to be in the city. That's why it says that, and that's the intent behind it. I'm not sure the legal requirements as it relates to that. Is there a legal standing behind that? I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to ask the city attorney. I don't have a problem. I'd be happy to reach out to our city attorney's office and ask him if there's any legal requirement that be the case. I mean, is there a desire? Well, I guess I should ask the larger question. Thank you for bringing it up. Is there an interest by at least, well, all of you? I would need all of you to say, yes, that's a great idea. If one of you is like, man, I'm not interested in that, then you'll have to take it up at the Planning Commission when it comes before you.
I think they should be used in the city. I mean, I think the whole idea is to provide affordable housing here and not necessarily, somewhere like a Tascadero. I mean, I think it's workforce housing and moderate income housing here.
I would certainly prefer it in Morro Bay, but I was just looking at it practically, and the problem is so vast and it's a little bit overwhelming. And I just, from a practical standpoint, and with rapidly appreciating land values and housing values in Morro Bay, I just doesn't seem to me that it's a likely solution that we're ever going to get in front of it, and we're going to have to do something a little more imaginative. But
over time, we've used our housing in lieu monies to support affordable housing.
I can speak to that. We have used our affordable housing in lieu funds to capitalize other funding, if you will, to bring into the city. The most recent example is at 555 Main. That's the senior housing. That was a multi-million dollar, almost $3 million project. The city used $600,000 to purchase the land. The developer was able to get county home funds, state and federal tax credits, federal home loan bank funding. So there are programs out there where, yes, land is expensive. I mean, every city grapples with this in California, where it's expensive to provide affordable housing for your residents. And so how do you do that? And oftentimes it's partnering with developers and applicants who can, you know, use city money as seed money to bring other money in.
We also did the two rehab projects.
Oh, yeah. And then we another affordable housing developer, People Self-Help, City Council just awarded them $50,000 from its affordable housing in lieu bank, and that's going to renovate and extend the affordability on the Sequoia apartments. So that's a development that the city awarded almost $500,000 in the 1990s to develop that. It was a vacant lot back then. And that affordability period is running out because it's only good for 30 years. And so for $50,000, we gave them some local match, and that developer will be applying for tax credit funding.
Yeah.
And if funded, that'll be another multi-million dollar project. It'll renovate it'll not only renovate and rehab the apartments, but it'll extend affordability for 55 years,
yeah.
Which is, you know, a really good return on investment for the city. And then Ocean View Manor,
yeah.
456 Elena Street, that's an example of the same thing, where the city gave them $50,000, they turned it into tax credit money, brought in millions of dollars to the community, and quite frankly did a really nice job renovating that development, if you've been there. So
those are all recent examples.
Mm-hmm.
So we do use them, and we do get inquiries about use of the funds, and we've had other people come in and looking to do projects and saying, would the city be willing to provide funding towards it? So, I mean, it is good to keep it in-house, because we do have these things that come up that we're able to leverage. And really what they're coming to us for is, as long as we put a little bit of skin in the game, they're able to score higher on their tax credit applications. So, I mean, it is important that we keep some of the money in-house here, because it can leverage those types of projects.
I would want to keep it in-house, and I think that's part of our vision for the city, okay. is to be able to provide that affordable housing in whatever way we can.
Okay.
So.
It's an interesting question, though, Joe. So I'll run it by the city attorney. So when we get to Planning Commission, we can have another discussion about it, and I'll have an answer for you.
One thing I could see, though, is going just outside of our boundary. So thinking like Little Morro Creek Road, which is actually county up there, and it's ag land, and I think there's all sorts of other issues. But there may be places just outside our physical borders that might be possible.
I guess I was just thinking of sort of how to get the biggest bang for the buck. Not that we're not doing something currently to address the problem, is just how could you maximize that with the least amount of unintended consequences. Anyway, it's
okay. So back to the hazards and shoreline protection section. It's 17, chapter 17.18. Anything in there? Questions, comments? Basically includes all of our standards for development in hazard areas. And then some of the new policies in here, you know, specifically address sea level rise and what happens with that and what we're supposed to be doing over time with that. You've seen, you know, some of that in our background documentation in the community baseline assessment, the resiliency report, and then in Plan Morro Bay itself. This is sort of the implementation of those items.
I have on page 47, number four, underfloors. You're talking about slope and stability hazards. What does that sentence mean? Areas between the lowest floor and the finished grade, the lowest floor and the finished grade, shall not exceed 6 feet in height, but on page 46, the building elevation facing the downslope shall have a maximum height of 20 feet from the I was getting all confused. What does that mean?
Okay, so the maximum height of the 20 feet for a face of a building, some of our steeper lots in town, you see some of the houses on it, how our height's calculated is average natural grade. So while the height might be 25 feet, a portion of a building might be 30 feet tall, 32 feet tall. And so we have some houses out there that have walls, oftentimes on the side. Like you'll get stepping up or stepping down because there'll be decks and floors are offset from one another, so you get articulation there. But what you often don't is you'll have a wall on the side that's at the setback line. That wall will be 30 feet tall. And so that's one of the things we're trying to avoid. And so that item, the downhill facing building elevation issue is that. Is saying, hey, we don't want any wall that's taller than 20. So if you got up to that 20 foot, you'd have to do some sort of inset or something to provide the articulation versus having this massive, wall plane that's sitting there. And so that's what that's meant to address.
So the lowest floor is where you're starting, where the building. And so the area between that and the top of the finished grade can't be more than 6 feet, or.
So it's saying, hey, if you're
between the lowest floor and the ground is not more than 6 feet.
Yeah.
Okay.
It deals with underfloor space.
I was going the other way. Thanks. Okay.
Yeah, this stuff is mostly what you'd expect when you're dealing with hazard types issues. You have to address them. You have to give us studies that support what you're doing. You have to give us soils reports and things like that. If you don't have any other comments on that, we could move to the back of the document at chapter 17.22 performance standards. I don't think you weighed in on that last time. At least I didn't have any notes related to that section.
I think I had a question on page 79.
Okay. In the parking standards?
Yeah. Oh, wait. No.
Want a hard copy? Yeah. I don't think we talked about parking. I have a quick question about parking. There's nothing worse than you go into these parking lots and they have a whole bunch of things labeled compact, and they got a bunch of SUVs in there.
That's an enforcement issue. Yeah,
it's an enforcement issue, but it's true. But where does the 25% number come from in terms of the amount of spaces that can be compact?
Current code. Yeah, it brings forward the current code.
Okay, but do you know where? I mean, what is the justification for that?
But most cities will have numbers in the 20-25% range. Some have can have up to 40. I've seen.
Is that the percentage of compact cars on the road, or where does that come from?
I don't know where it derives.
It just seems like hardly ever do you ever see compact cars in them, and so I'm just wondering if there's 10% compact cars on the road. I have no idea what the number is, but somehow that's a gross overestimate in this area, at least, of how many cars would actually fit in a space like that.
Okay. While you're looking, is it okay? On page 68, when you're talking about transit accessibility, all the way through, I noticed that the required parking places are reduced. If you're located within 1/4 mile or near a transit stop, the required number of parking spaces is reduced. If it's, I guess I'm thinking of park and drive. Wouldn't you need more parking? Why is that? Why are they always reduced near transit stops?
Because the idea would be that you could use public transportation.
The people would go there
without
using their cars.
Yeah. Not park and ride lots.
Yeah, no, park and ride lots would be it, would be something else. Yeah.
That was the question I had, though. But the fact that if there's a proximity to a transit stop, I mean, they don't really specify what kind of a stop. Meaning, it's one thing to have, an apartment building near a bus stop that will take you the 15 miles in the San Luis Obispo to your place of work, but it's another thing for a local bus stop that might take you four blocks to the grocery store. And one has a significant impact on transportation, and one's pretty negligible. So that's what I noticed.
I mean, just even our transit system is actually pretty good in town. You can take the smaller buses that go around inside of Morro Bay, and you can take it to the bus station that takes you into San Luis. So I mean, it's all connected.
Okay. Oh, fair enough.
And then during the peak summer months, you have the trolley system, so you have even more opportunities to get places in town. And to be able to, and that also takes you by where the bus stop is, so you could actually take the bus into town and ride around on the trolley to different places and get back on it that way. So our transit system is actually pretty decent from that standpoint. And we have transit stops like that all over town, so.
For example, sorry, my thing wasn't on. Like the one that's on Market Street, the city bought that property. It's considered right now a public parking lot until however the development goes with that. So if somebody on Main Street or Morro Bay Boulevard wanted to do some kind of use that required parking, which wasn't available, does that count?
So it would have to be an affirmative action on the part of the council to say, yes, that's a parking facility that can be used for those types of things.
Okay.
I think what it would envision is, oh, we could have public parking facilities that include like a parking structure somewhere or more than one. Mm-hmm. And one way to pay for that would be to have it be used as parking for residents as well. Mm-hmm. Because you get into the slow months in town and our parking facilities aren't going to be all that full. Mm-hmm. So this would... you could actually see this sort of shared use thing take place, and you get a little bit of synergy with that, and it could be a means by which you could pay for that potentially. And probably, because it would be mostly filled idea, or depending on where you located them, mostly filled during our peak months, then you would probably be looking at, that's what you see for parking areas. Residents have a discount. You get to, our normal rate is this, but you get to pay 25% of that. And you can buy a year pass or a six-month pass for it or whatever. I mean, there's lots of parking options that you see out there.
And then, did anybody else have anything?
No, I'll defer.
Bicycle parking, long-term bicycle parking. How much of an issue is that? I mean, I've seen it. So say, for example, when my daughter was living in L.A. area and you had apartment complexes and they had places within a gated area to lock up bicycles long term. Is that kind of thing? So it would relate more to that kind of development? Because in our town right now, I don't quite see that we need some cage for parking bicycles.
It would be for that, and it could be associated with new commercial facilities. As well, so you could have employees, because you want to encourage them to bike to work, right? Well, you want to have if you're going to have them come bike to work, you probably don't want them, with just a bike rack sitting out in front. You probably need to have a secure area, where they can have that. It's
okay.
That's how it's typically differentiated.
Okay. Go ahead.
My notes refer to different pages here, so this may be a little confusing, but maybe I can identify what I'm talking about. There was the provision about, two parking spaces. Two parking spaces for each unit? No. It was
in a single unit for dwelling.
Encourage units, but not for the recreation. two parking spaces for a two-bedroom unit. Does that sound right?
There was two parking spaces for a two-unit dwelling.
Page 65 is the table. Maybe that'll...
You know what?
So the table that has all the parking requirements is on, and the residential piece is on 65. Residential is at the top if it was for residential.
I think I thought we might have talked about this last time, but the idea of the proximate public parking facilities, and I think the question was, why would it have to be a public parking facility? Why couldn't it just be any parking facility?
I'm sorry, which item is
it? I'm sorry, I'm on page 68.
68, okay.
If somebody were to build, say, a private parking garage, for example, why would you not get credit for that?
You would. But that would be, if they were building it, that scenario would be in association with a development or something, so it would be a different scenario. This is just saying the city could have parking facilities, and the likelihood of those, one of the ways that we, this policy is meant to be flexible. And so it's not necessarily that we would have a public parking facility and that we would use that in association with this policy, but we might, because it could be the way that we actually get one built. Because you know, you have to, based on how much revenue you can generate, needs to pay for it, and it needs to pay for, if it's, is it manned, how do we enforce it, you know, parking, if it's going to be paid parking and that type of thing, which would have to be paid parking.
Okay, but this doesn't say anything either. It just says it's owned by the city.
Well,
so I'm not sure which entity owns it.
So this is similar to what we have in our current parking ordinance. So it's talking about if there is a use and you're proposing something and you are within 1,200 feet of something that's public, just no different than you can park in the street, you can waive your parking spaces with a minor use permit. It wouldn't be a private parking lot, because if it's, you know, a restaurant and they want to use parking spaces from someone else, the city can't require another private use to use its parking garage for another private use. So the nexus has to be private to public.
But the policies also do allow for you to have to acquire parking from somebody, say,
with
they
an agreement.
Parking with an agreement. So
yeah.
It does have that flexibility in it as well.
So it's saying that if there is a public parking lot nearby, then it would provide for that type of parking need to be satisfied with a use.
As long as somebody who would come to the premises would have the right to use that parking, whatever that is, I'm not sure who owns it is really... you're saying that if it was a private parking, maybe somebody wouldn't have the right to own it. That's what I'm not
consent.
Really...
So I think all this is providing another opportunity to deal with parking. So if you don't have it in here, then it's like, oh, well, we don't have a policy that says you can do that. Well, we're saying, hey, no, you can. This is one way to achieve your parking requirements. We're good if this works out. The other ones would be through agreements. If you had an off-site thing like we were talking about, that's another, you know, opportunity. We're really, the idea is to make these as flexible as possible for projects to be able to move forward. You know, that's one of the issues that we run into right now is the inflexibility in the ordinance ends up being a disincentive for redevelopment in town, or reinvestment, if you want to look at it that way. We're trying to remove, again, barriers so we do get some of the investment that we need and that we want, and that's been expressed through this entire Plan Morro Bay process, is we want some investment into the town. So this is helping with that.
In all this thing about parking, somewhere in we've talked about parking lots and maybe, you know, and street parking and stuff. But did I read somewhere that a parking structure is not a preferred structure in the city? And that maybe if it was underground parking or something, but not necessarily just a standalone parking structure?
I think the city would be open to parking structure. In fact, the parking management plan talks about that as a solution. Again, that was adopted a while ago, back in 2007. But that's one of the opportunities the city could have. Whether that's some sort of public-private partnership, whether that's the city going out and acquiring a lot and building it, or what have you. I mean, we definitely would be one option that's out there and available, and one honestly we've looked at for some different locations. You could put a parking lot in the Triangle lot, potentially. Obviously, we're looking to put a boat hall facility there, and we're going through the feasibility study component of that right now, and I think the RFP's out, or maybe it just recently closed, I'm not sure which, but, I mean, that might happen there. If that's determined not to be viable, we could look at other uses that could go in there, and certainly some sort of parking structure could go in there. So.
Okay. Thank you.
I was looking at the short-term vacation rental, one for four people, based on maximum occupancy.
I'm sorry, what page are you on?
I'm on page 67. So if the short-term vacation rental occupancy suggestions are put in place, that it's two people to a bedroom, two-bedroom unit, four people, one parking space?
That's the way that it's written now, yes.
Yeah.
I might add a space, would you say? Because I could see two couples showing up in two cars.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. But I can also see a family showing up as well.
Yeah.
And I, it's typical, I don't have a solution. I have a question.
I think, you know, we looked at it, and I think the idea was that it could be both. You could have multiple folks showing up there. Certainly that's the case. It seems, you know, in talking with our vacation rental folks, that a majority of them tend to be used by families. Mm-hmm. And so we came up with this. This doesn't account for the most recent change by the Planning Commission to further reduce the amount of folks in the building. Mm-hmm. So as you have it right now, it's two per bedroom, which is where the draft of the vacation rental ordinance is currently, based on Planning Commission input. So that reduces the overall, you know, occupancy of the site. And most of these have some sort of parking, so you could actually fit two cars on there anyway. So but if you do think that we should increase it, then certainly open to that, and we can run that up the flagpole. I'm sure the Planning Commission will weigh in on it too when it gets there.
Any other stuff on parking?
That's not driveways, is it? I had a question on driveways. Are we at driveways?
Sure.
I think there is a. I think our parking section talks about driveways.
Okay. So that might. I didn't notice anything. When it talked about this, the surfaces for driveways, and I was wondering why we weren't. Have we considered mandating permeable driveways? I guess is what I was thinking.
So we could encourage it. We can't mandate it. There are areas in town where you can't put permeable pavers because water doesn't drain. We have soil types that don't allow that to happen, so that would be disastrous were we to require it in those locations. We could create a policy that's a preference. Often we talk about it often at the Planning Commission. And oftentimes that's projects can get conditioned or they're encouraged to incorporate those. So we could work a condition that's something like that, unless infeasible due to soil type or something like that.
I'm just, one is to simply mention it so people think about it, and two, maybe to incentivize it in some way so that we're encouraging people where it's appropriate to do something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like the input from the rest of you, but I don't have a problem creating a, you know, policy in there that encourages permeable pavers. It's a good idea where it's appropriate.
I vote yes.
Anybody not liking the idea?
No, I think encouraging is fine.
Okay,
sure.
All right. I
like all the landscaping requirements.
That's probably my most exciting, you know, get in this document is to have a whole landscaping section that requires landscaping in association with projects, mm-hmm. And then, you know, how it's pushed throughout the documents.
Well, but especially in parking lots, which can become those just heat magnet to kind of places.
Yeah.
It'll cool
parking
down
lots don't tend to be very attractive.
No, really ugly and hot.
And I was particularly pleased to see the notion of putting walls in front of parking lots when they face the main street so that it does look more attractive. I really like that. I wasn't sure what the enforcement mechanism is when trees aren't cared for.
Well, that was sort of my question, is you have, you know, these requirements of new projects when they go in. And as you say, often in the planning commission, you know, they want people to paint things certain colors, they want things to be a certain way. And I always wondered, well, what happens if, you know, once you're done with it and you've built the thing, it seems like you could just then do whatever you want, right?
Right. I discovered that when they tried to repaint their building and it wasn't the right color and they had to repaint it again.
Oh, that
yeah, so I would say there's a little bit of a different standard, you know, for that, you know, as it relates between planning commission approvals of like single family homes and things and commercial developments. Commercial developments, you hold them to what was approved, you know, originally. So if they weren't maintaining their landscaping, we would go after them to have them improve the landscaping because that's part of the deal you got for the permit.
Okay.
We would do something similar on residential lots, but we don't say, oh, hey, you changed the tree out. I don't know that we would get to that level because it's okay to, you know, in residential neighborhoods, everybody has a different plant palette. You're not trying to be consistent. But commercial developments, you start changing stuff, you can have a dramatic change in how the property looks, and so that would be something that if they wanted to make huge changes, we'd probably be taking something like that back to the planning commission and review it because it's not really appropriate.
Okay, so they're expected to maintain it mm-hmm. in that state. Okay, and what happens if they don't? The thing's already built, right? I mean, you can't really.
Yeah, we can find them daily.
If you're doing that. Okay,
yeah,
okay.
It's at some point that they'll get tired of paying us money for nothing and want to use the money to,
yeah,
you
to
know,
actually
go
do
plant.
The job. Yeah, yeah, okay. All right. Well, yeah. That's fine. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
When you find, do they actually pay or do they just keep accumulating a bill?
Well, if they didn't pay us, we'd take them to court.
Okay. there's
a ratcheting level. You know, normally we send letters and go talk to them and try to work things out. You know, we don't try to be the heavy-handed, you know, government. And largely, you know, 99% of the time we're successful. I mean, I've been here for 4 years. We've had code enforcement for three of those. And we've only issued a couple of citations, and I think we pulled both of them back because they actually realized we were serious and then came into compliance. So that's pretty good. I mean, that's basically 100% compliance with folks that we've engaged with. Sometimes it takes a while. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of patience that goes into it, but there hasn't been a desire on the part of the, you know, at least the council to be very heavy-handed. So we've tried to take the approach of working with people as opposed to fining them and dragging them into court. But that opportunity is always there, and if somebody said just refused to play ball, then that's what we would do.
Compact parking spaces.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's used to reach a number of parking spaces that might not otherwise be reached, I guess. But the problem is, you know, well, actually, you know, what's your experience? Do people observe it and that not too big cars do not park in small spaces and create all the unintended consequences?
I think largely smaller cars park in compact spaces and larger cars park in regular spaces. But what you notice all of the time is the one big truck that pulls into the compact space and is sticking out into the drive aisle and is a pain to get around, and that's the thing that you notice. There's usually not several of them. There's usually one, two. That's been my experience with it. So it works mostly, and then the issue becomes enforcement. If there is a problem that's created over time, that's the more difficult piece of it, but then it ends up being on private property, so part of that enforcement largely falls to the property owner to resolve the issue as opposed to the city. If it were a city parking lot, that would be different. We could, you know, we have the ability to tow cars and things like that.
Yeah.
And I would add, I think sometimes it's a little bit of the path of least resistance, and so a large car may come into a lot and they just want to go about their business and they're going to take the first space, and if there's no one parked on the left and the right of that compact space, they just kind of park wherever. It's some of that, but
that was sort of the nature of my earlier question. Yeah. Is that it seems like there's a lot more big cars and SUVs than there are regular spaces for them, and so people just take the first one available. I don't know, but a lot of times it just seems like there's there's just a lot of big cars. There's not more than one. There's a lot of big cars parked in the small spaces. So I don't know, but
yeah.
Maybe
then
I'm just
noticing
the outliers, but. Mm-hmm.
Seems like every time I look for a parking place, there's big cars there.
This is not on this chapter. I can't remember where it is, but on wetlands and stuff, and how you're not supposed to. There's the designations that something can't be built within 100 feet of something. Mm-hmm. How did the cloisters get built? Was this in? Were these in place at that time? Were these rules in place at the time?
It's actually ended up being clustered to avoid actually environmentally sensitive habitat. They clustered the development. It didn't originally look like that. I think it originally had twice the number of homes or something mm-hmm. in it. Is that right,
yeah.
City?
Yeah.
So, and then it went through a process with the city, and then it morphed even further once it got to Coastal Commission. They made changes to it, and then that's how you ended up with sort of the clustered areas, and that was to avoid and protect the environmentally sensitive habitat areas. And they had that's the whole little wetland thing, and there was an enhancement to recreate wetland
right.
that
mm-hmm.
they might have otherwise been impacting, or that was in poor shape when the subdivision was going through the process. I think there was some indication about that as well.
But some of the houses don't look like they're 100 feet from an ESHA area, so has the ESHA area been encroaching, or was that a line that was pushed when they were built?
I don't have an answer to that. That was approved a while ago.
I haven't
dug that deeply into the subdivision. I just know that it was reconfigured to address resource issues that existed on the site, and that's why it looks the way that it does. I know that there was a lot more housing proposed. I think it was, like I said, I think it was double that, and I think Coastal Commission found issue with that because it was encroaching into areas they found to be environmentally sensitive yeah. habitat. And I think additional conditions were placed on the project to deal with impacts to some of those areas and impact to buffer areas, and that's why they have the sort of wetland piece in there that's filling in at this point.
So I guess what I always wonder when I'm down there is, would this be permitted today? Would be going the same law, the same rules that were in place when that was permitted are still in place, right? But some of these overlays would
it's largely correct.
It more.
Yes. There's not much that's dissimilar now. It'd be the same.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot of detail that goes into how it's configured, and I don't know what trade-offs were made, if any. I don't know any of the reasoning behind it. I haven't looked through that approval. It's fairly old. So. And I haven't looked through the Coastal Commission record to look at what the problems were and what the issues were. It certainly was back in a time where the city was arm's distance with the Coastal Commission. We'll do our thing, you do your thing. It's definitely not how we operate today. I mean, they're engaged with us, especially on larger projects, from the beginning. In fact, we send stuff to them to get their input so we're not sending an applicant off in a wrong direction. And so we're avoiding those sort of, oh, you thought you were going to have, 150 houses, but guess what? You get 75. That type of thing. You don't want to have those types of things happen. That's not a good process to go through, so.
What's the story of the city-owned lot that's right on right near the cloisters on the it's on Highway 1 and I've forgotten what's San Jacinto is that yeah something.
Yeah that's
what's the status of that?
It's going to Planning Commission at the first meeting in August.
What?
Six lot subdivision.
Okay, because I thought they had tried to do that earlier, but then there weren't enough leftover lots or something that they were leftover houses they were allowed to build or something like that.
And we vetted it all through Coastal Commission. They're fine with it. I don't know where that idea came from. It was just weird. There is development, so there was never a part of the overall development potential for the subdivision. It was a dedicated fire station site, but we're not going to put a fire station there. And so the city went through the process, like, okay, we'll subdivide it and sell it off. And I think they thought, look, make a little bit of money with this. But what we failed to do is we didn't get a coastal development permit for the subdivision map, which invalidated it. I don't know why they did that again. That was at a time frame when we were, arm's length from the Coastal Commission doing our own thing. And eventually when push came to shove, Coastal was like, well, just show us your coastal development permit and it's all fine. Well, we didn't issue one for it. And that was a problem. So fast forward today, the council, agreed to divest themselves of the property, and we have an extended purchase agreement to allow them to go through the discretionary process, and they're doing that. And first shot at taking a look at that will be that first meeting in August. So it's been a while to get there. They've been a lot of back and forth with the group that purchased it, but we're getting close.
All these thoughts keep coming up, getting in my head. With respect to tandem parking, you know, I've talked about this at the Planning Commission, where it tends often not to be used. But of course, what is the solution other than, you know, foisting the parking burden on a neighbor down the street? I mean, is there any way to sort of authorize a neighbor to, you know, register a complaint, you know, if his neighbor consistently parks in front of his house rather than using the available second space in the driveway, or is it, what's his option?
Interesting question. You could certainly file a complaint, but everybody can park. The street is the right-of-way. Everybody right. has the same rights of access to it. And your neighbor can park all 14 of his cars in the street and take up every space on the street, and that's completely acceptable because it's public. And so, I mean, that was...
What about commercial establishments that have, you know, like car repair and things that they put their cars on, instead of having their own lots or something, they put cars along the street? There are a couple of those.
So they're not supposed to store their cars on the street. If they're specifically associated with the development, with the business, we can make them move them. They're supposed to maintain their cars on site, not on the street. So it would be, you know, that's dealt with typically on a complaint basis. And then, obviously, you can't park anything on the street for more than 72 hours, or you can be ticketed. Not that we necessarily would. It would just be based on a complaint and then followed up on. And we do... Usually when that happens, code enforcement will often start the process and then turn it over to PD, and PD will cite.
Can I pursue that point just one step further? I mean, could you condition the whatever application is being made and involves using tandem parking, could there be a condition in that permit, which is essentially the owner's promise to make his best effort to use tandem parking in the driveway, which then gives somebody who's complaining some basis, you know, for pursuing that?
Well, I mean, it's no different than having a garage and filling it with junk and not using it. You know, I mean, that's the issue, right? You know, I mean, in many ways, it's interesting. You know, we had the conversation about garages last time, right? Like, are we going to have garages or are we not going to have garages? And so having the parking spaces available and out of a setback, because that's still the requirement, you just don't have the garage there, open parking and stuff, but you can't store junk there. So those spaces will always be available versus, oh, the parking's in the garage, it's good. But it's not good. Your garage is full of stuff. So there's some ancillary benefits to, you know, that whole concept right there. I don't know that we could really, you know, condition or enforce that. I don't think we can tell somebody they can't park on the street. The street is public. So prohibiting somebody from parking there, probably not able to do that.
I think it gets back to healthy neighborhoods, knowing your neighbors, talking to them, you know, having those kinds of dialogues. And some of what we've talked about in our city planning is hopefully having those kinds of neighborhoods that are structured so that people are outside walking and talking to each other. And I do think that some of the concerns people have had with vacation rentals, hate to bring that up again, but you know, knowing your neighbors and the people who are parking there, and why there's suddenly so many cars in front of your house.
You know. Big issue.
No.
I mean, one of the most significant things that come out of the vacation rental thing is, hey, you're going to have a parking requirement now. Because right now, the ordinance, the way it sits in Chapter 5, doesn't have that. So I have no hook. When people complain about it, I'm like, the only thing I can do is you can have a certain number of people in a house. I mean, that's not a great hook. And difficult to enforce. By the time we hear about it, you know, it's usually after the fact. So.
But like you just said, the street is public. I mean, so you can have these parking requirements, but if it's a public street, then you can't force them. I mean, you can't keep them from parking in front of the neighbor's house.
Yeah, but we can limit the number of folks that are at the vacation rentals. Often the case in some of the neighborhoods, we get competing, you know, complaints about things when projects come before the planning commission. You're like, our neighbors are all parked. It's them. It's not us. Okay. It's kind of funny.
Anything else leading up to performance standards before we get there? We're good? We can always come back.
Performance standards, you know, are one of the things that we use as it relates to complaints that we get for how businesses operate or what's happening on a piece of property. So these are important. Our code enforcement officers rely on things like this to deal with noise issues and those types of things. So, and clutter and stuff on properties and garbage stored inappropriately and noise and light and glare and all those types of things that, you know, you could certainly see being an issue.
Do we have an ordinance about, and especially in our new buildings, about fireplaces and smoke? You know, I was partly thinking of barbecue stuff and the businesses that do that and the issues they've had in San Luis Obispo, for example, with the Thursday Farmers Market and excessive smoke issues. But I know there are some communities, even in Pennsylvania, where they don't allow fireplaces anymore because they've had such bad air quality problems with, because they're using them a lot.
Yeah, the building code doesn't allow you to put wood-burning fireplaces in. There's an exception. They're very expensive. You can put one in to meet the code requirement. Basically, what you're putting on it is a catalytic converter that scrubs everything that comes in. Yeah. And those things are prohibitively expensive. I think I would much rather have a gas fireplace because they're, you know, a fifth the cost of the ones that do allow you to burn it, because basically it's the filtration system you're putting on it, which is similar to the filtration systems we put on the barbecues that are in the buildings now, right? They're not cheap.
So we do have one then.
In the building code. That's the California building code.
There's no wood-burning fireplace.
Yep.
Okay.
What about barbecues outside?
So you can have... So the exception to the code is barbecues. You can have barbecues outside on private property. We don't... For commercial applications, no. You have to have filtration on it just like you do for restaurants.
There were a couple of restaurants, I think, that had issues in town.
Yep. Yeah. Brick House, you know, we had to have them put filtration on their facilities. It took us a while to get that dialed in. It's where it wasn't creating a huge nuisance issue like it was when they first started. And then they wanted to be able to still have barbecues outside. And we said, no, I'm not going to allow that. We have others come in and want to open them, and they're like, well, just show us how you're going to, remove the nuisance issue, because we'll issue you the business license, and the moment you start creating the smoke issue, we're going to shut you down, you know. And so they look into it, they're like, wow, it's really expensive to do that. Like, sure is.
Is the mechanism for amending the zoning code simply a vote of the city council?
Normally that would be the case, yes. So that's for the city's action on it. We would go through a planning commission. The planning commission is a land use authority and is required to make a recommendation to the city council on any ordinance changes to the zoning code. So you would make that recommendation, then it would be carried forward to council, and like any other ordinance, they would hear it, have a first reading and a second reading. And then in this instance, part of that process would be, okay, we're approving it, and there would be a portion in the ordinance that says, and send it off to Coastal for certification, because our zoning code, most of it anyway, is part of the city's local coastal program. It's the implementation program for it. So then we have to go to Coastal, and then Coastal has to say yay or nay, and ends up being a fairly long process when you amend things.
I was thinking specifically of, you know, fast emerging technologies that might really ease some of our parking considerations, but it would still, but that process of going to the Coastal Commission is a year and a half, or is it?
It's certainly at least a year. You know, that I'm hopeful that when we're done with all of our Plan More Obey stuff, that it only takes them about 6 months to get through it. And the reason I'm hopeful is they're actually reviewing our drafts right now. They viewed our administrative draft and gave us input, and then and we put that online. And then now they're reviewing the public draft. We just found that out. We have a bunch of stuff in front of them right now that they need to respond to, but they're reviewing the whole public draft now to give us input to help with that process. We didn't know they were doing it. They just said, "Hey, can we get a word copy of it, right, or whatever what they asked for?" So that's good. They're doing what they said they would do, which is great. And I think that process is meant to facilitate when we're done. We've done the things that they want. It's in there, and so they can review it much more quickly and go through it. Versus what happened when the city did it last time. We didn't really talk to Coastal much. We shipped the whole thing off to them, and they, sent us back a thing saying, "Not so much." You have several entire sections of your general plan that are not in conformance with the Coastal Act. So, I'm cautiously optimistic. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else on any of that? Pretty straightforward, I think.
Yeah. There wasn't a huge section. I think everything else, unless there's something else, want to talk about inside that, we can move on to the zoning code, zoning map. Sorry.
Yeah. Let's do the map.
All right. So this is the zoning map. You can't read it there, but I have it broken down into smaller sections.
Oh, I can do that.
Like me, you take your glasses off. Well, it depends on how tiny it is. This is pretty tiny.
If you look at it on the website, it allows you to zoom in really close. So,
yeah.
But we have some zoomed in slides for you.
Yeah, we have a few of the, as Cindy said, the zoomed in slides. This picks up a couple of areas that people have been talking about, right? I think Susan, you referenced Susan Snyder. I think you referenced this area that abuts Morro Bay Boulevard. So that's the pink, and the top outlined area. There's the pink, and then there's the dappled blue below it. And it talks about we have a mixed use overlay over that to pick up some of those items there, and it runs down at Main Street as well. We have those in other areas of the city as well, but this was kind of pointing out that corridor because there's been some discussion at least on the portion that abuts Morro Bay Boulevard, and this was a mixed use thing is to encourage some of the residential and that type of thing.
Yeah, but what is the transitional mixed use? Is it just because it's just that literally it's a transition because you've got two things next to each other? Is that all that means?
So you're going from one zone to the other. Yeah,
okay.
You're going from a commercial zone into a residential zone, and you have these things in there that, as you pointed out, you're like, hey, you got this zoning is split, and you have. But you have one property, and it's just got this one building on it. Like, why aren't we just making it?
I think I was looking specifically down, because I will admit to a personal interest. My house is looks like it's split. Maybe my lot might be split in half. I can't really tell. But, going down Piney, you've got sort of half of a block in one thing and half of a block in another thing.
We tried to resolve as many of the split zoning items that we could. The problem is, in many cases there's a lot there, and that's why the zone is drawn where it is. It's just there might be two lots, but there's just one APN, one assessor's parcel number, and there's just one development on it, and so that's why it ends up that way. And so in those instances, typically we wouldn't remove the split zoning; we just leave it the way that it was, and it may or may not be non-conforming. What we tried to do with the mixed use thing is to probably bring more of them into conformance as well. And then you see the area down below. I think Mr. Martini has been in here on several occasions talking about that area. And we have a mixed-use overlay over that sort of picks up the nature of that zoned area and the fact that we have parcels down there that are split as well, with the portion above the bluff being residential and the portion below the bluff being commercial. And I think Ms. Winholtz has also expressed an interest in that area as well.
It just seems weird that there's some most places they're bordered by streets.
And ideally, that's the way that you have it set up. But one of the things we're dealing with is existing development patterns. And so we had to go. We went in many cases lot by lot to look what was on them, and where we could resolve them, we did. But what you again also often happen is there's two lots there. There's an underlying lot line, meaning if the building were to go away, you could have two different things there. And then do we really want to have that commercial development sitting directly across from the residential across the street? And so that's kind of why we have some of the splits remain is to have that sort of harmonious transition versus...
And also, too, in some of those areas, the lots are deep, and so you'd have commercial that would be fronting on Morro Bay Boulevard, and then south of that is Pacific, and if someone's fronting on Pacific, they're facing across the street at a residential use, but if that's one lot, you don't want to extend that commercial all the way to Pacific. So we had to address that with this transitional mixed use, and then, but to minimize the impact to someone... as much as possible so that they don't have to deal with the split zoning. Sorry to interrupt.
You're the one who knows what you're talking about.
And I do think, just looking at the Piney Way thing you're talking about there, I mean, you've got, but you've got houses on Piney Way, and then you've got houses, so they're one lot, but then there's a house behind it.
Yeah.
That's on the other street, which it, to me sort of makes sense because Piney is a much more...
It's a busier street.
It's a busier street.
But it's not any wider than any of the other streets. It's just more heavily traveled.
I think it's a collector.
Yeah, it is.
Piney is. I think it's identified in our circulation as a collector.
Yeah. So to me, that sort of makes sense on the other side. You know, those lots that are... almost makes more sense to do it in between. Mm-hmm. The yards of the houses than to do it on
then
the street, across the street you have somebody who's in a whole different zone than you are.
Right. Yeah, so. But if most of the other zones are done by streets, and so you'd have sort of one, you have, say, a house here and a house here, and the one house, the house on Piney is in, like, a whatever the medium density, then the house behind it is low density, and so it just seems, I don't know, it seems odd to do it that way, but... I guess.
I would also point out that in your packet you have this handout here, and on the back side of it has how it compares to the general plan of coastal program as it relates to the land use plan versus the zoning districts. It kind of gives you a comparison as to what something's called in one versus the other, which is kind of interesting. Sometimes there are one-for-one change, and which is what we tried to do where we could. So there's a nice consistency between the two, versus having different names for the things to make it confusing. Because it's people will look at our different maps that we have, and they're confused whether they're actually looking at the land use map for the general plan of local coastal program, or they're looking at the zoning map. That happens frequently. At least now we're calling things similar things, so there's maybe hopefully less of that. And so the policies correspond with one another as well, versus having different names for them and folks not understanding that there's both.
Would there be a reason not to have them just be the same? I mean, because I look at under zoning, industrial, coastal dependent, and then under general plan, it's coastal dependent, industrial. Why not call them both the same?
I don't know the answer to that. that might have picked up the existing name.
Yeah,
for the general plan, I think we kept the existing name.
Okay.
And then in the general plan, we had that combined thing because some of our zoning has that designation on it for the coastal dependent ones, and then we have just the ones that don't have it. So I think that's where that came from. We had to differentiate between the two different industrial types. That's my recollection.
The fishing designation, you've got commercial fishing and then commercial and recreational fishing, which do not seem to be the same things.
Which one are we looking at?
I'm looking at the waterfront and harbor area district.
Okay.
Those don't actually, I mean, the commercial part seems to be similar, but the recreational.
It's just how they've labeled the land use.
The CF zoning allows for recreational fishing.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
So I'm going to ask a real layperson's question here. One thing I've been wondering about for a long time is the line for the coastal zone comes down here and then goes up the hill and we never see it again. So is it just that, I mean, yeah, where?
It does come down south again. It's just you don't see it because it's out in the county. So it,
wow.
It'll go out like this and then it goes like that.
Yeah.
And then as you get further south down the coast, it does go closer to the coast. But there is just...
Yeah.
In our section of the county, there is that's adjacent to our city. Uh-huh. There is a section that where it goes east quite a bit, and then it goes west.
And is that because of watershed and viewshed issues, or why does the coastal zone go all the way so far? I mean, you can see it sort of hugging the coastline just as it comes in from north of town.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I've asked coastal that in the past. And not received an answer that I would put out there right now.
Yeah. There's some interesting boundaries, too, like even in Southern California,
yeah.
where, like, well, city of Santa Barbara, for instance, very, very fascinating how that coastal zone boundary works. You would think that there would be portions that should be in the coastal zone that are not, much like here. And so one has to wonder whether it is, as you said, viewshed, and whether or not there may be other, you know, was it whether political decisions made were was it? Yeah, I don't know.
It's this is dramatically different than, you know, the coastal zone boundary line. You know, when I was in Pismo, like only half the city in Pismo is it hugs the coast just like Morro Bay does, but only half of the city is in the coastal zone.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So convenient or not, we had to operate out of two separate zoning codes when I was there, which was. For a town of 7,000, not fantastic.
Half of the city on the ocean side of the highway? Or was the highway the separating line?
The highway was not the separating area. Most of the north end of Pismo is in the coastal zone. It was the southern end that it's not. So it pops out as you get... in the area where the outlet center is, and then go across the highway there. The area all up on the hill, that's all outside the coastal zone. So again, like I said, it's approximately half the city, at least from a lot standpoint and size standpoint, is outside. So I would say this is not the norm. It's not normally what you see. And so not completely clear as to why it looks like that. I have, we did kind of zoom that, like, this is the area towards the north. Down just kind of showing it, kind of zoomed in, you know, versions of it, and see the coastal zone boundary line on that more closely as well. And that one little area of town that's outside the coastal zone. Sort of middle of town at the 41 area, going up to Cloisters. Down at the south end. I think we're still working on a couple of the overlays, so you don't see them on the map, represented on the map. Coastal resources overlay we're working on. The outline for the Measure D area that you sort of see there in that like aqua color, we're working on that as well to better define that that area.
This part, this red and green that's on the right side of the roundabout, is that
It's the Tri-W site was subject to a referendum.
Oh, okay. But the red is district commercial.
Correct.
What is there now? That's just zoned that way. But
it's just zoned that way. There's nothing there. And then you have open space around it, ag land around it. It was appeared to be in response to a very large housing development that was proposed out there.
Mm.
Very large for Morro Bay, anyway.
And what's the status on that housing development that's supposed to be out by Bayside? There's 10 lots that are just
out by Bayside.
That's Seashell Cove.
Oh, is that next to Casa de Flores?
Yeah. The Planning Commission approved permits to build one of the houses. It's been subdivided. There are 10 legal lots out there. The original developer, to my knowledge, still owns it. Planning Commission approved permits to build one of the houses, and we don't have any other applications for the other 9 lots. So I don't know what their business plan is, but we are waiting on building permit applications for that first lot.
Yeah. We do have the across from there. We do have the Colmer subdivision going right now, 16 houses under construction.
Some of those, or one of those, is a low income?
Two.
Yeah, two.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
it's kind of exciting.
It is very exciting.
Yeah.
So is that same requirement on those that we were just talking about up on by Casa de Flores?
On that one, the way that subdivision was approved is they were allowed to pay affordable housing in lieu fees.
Okay.
So they're paying in lieu fees on the Black Hill Villas subdivision. That one, those will be rental. That'll be affordable rental housing.
In the Black Hills.
Yeah. The developer's going to keep the ownership, and it's been deed restricted, so has to stay affordable for a minimum of 30 or maybe 55 years. I don't remember the number. This particular developer has done that before with other developments in town where he works with the housing authority.
And affordable is based on?
It's based on federal guidelines that pass through the state and that the city follows. Typically, it's based on a percentage of the county median income. For his subdivision, I'm not sure if it's at 80% or 50%, but typically that's a standard affordable housing project. That would be the income limit, that you could make no more than 50 or 80% of what your county's median income is.
Deal with that thing is.
Okay, anything else on the maps? I know. Anything, Susan?
Nope.
Come on. How about you, Joe? Drill down.
I'm still looking at that area in red that's industrial to the east of the highway.
Say that again?
The area east of the highway, the red that's zoned industrial.
You know, if you're interested, I could send you a whole history of that.
It's zoned district commercial.
Commercial, I'm saying commercial.
Yeah, it was Measure H. It was Measure H. It also was part of the process that put in the water equivalency units. And the annexation limitations have to go to a vote and that type of thing. So it's a growth cap, yeah, basically, growth ordinance.
So there was a plan at one time to, well, I mean, was what in a few words, what was the plan?
It was back in the 80s, and it's, there was several hundred homes that were proposed, and the citizenry of Morro Bay reacted. They're like, we don't want that. And at the time, referendums were very popular. There were a lot of measures that are out there in various, in many cities that happened back in the 80s. It was a trend. I'm not sure if it was just, it was government doing things that people didn't want, or that was just the, you know, one of the things at the time. I don't know, but so they went through a vote. Went through a vote. They put it on the ballot. It passed, and so you get zoning by referendum, which is rarely a great way to zone property, but it does reflect a desire, and it does reflect the desire of the people. So, so there's that part of it. I mean, it's directly saying we didn't like this, and this is our response to that. And it's things like that you need to pay attention to, you know, when they happen. And so. It's unfortunate that it came to that end, but it did.
But what's the logic of it being zoned commercial as opposed to open space or agricultural?
So the Williams brothers, who own Tri-W, is the Williams brothers. They own property all over the county, and they had grocery stores. And so one of the things they were going to put out there was a grocery store, and then they were going to build housing. So they said, well, we can't take all economic value through this process, otherwise it wouldn't be legal, it would be a taking. And so they said, okay, well, we'll give you some commercial out here. And they aligned it carefully in the area that would be probably the most expensive to develop it. And so that's where you get that sort of shape out there. You have the drainage in the middle. They put some on both sides of it, which, you know, would likely require bridges and things like that to get out there. And it touches the area where we have a Highway 101 ramp, which you have to reconfigure the whole ramp. So that would easily be one of the most expensive projects ever built in the city from a commercial standpoint if they actually developed it. So they put land use on there and allow you to develop it, but it's not easy.
So who's they, the Williams brothers or the residents?
So Tri-W is owned by the Williams
right,
brothers.
Who put the restrictions on where?
The citizenry of Morro Bay.
Oh, I see.
That was in the referendum.
That's who the they was.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's who the they
40
was.
40 years ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. I would imagine there was a fairly large uproar about the intensity of development there, and there wasn't a whole lot of pushback on the part of the city to have something that was more acceptable, and hence the last resort was the referendum process, and that's what you ended up with. It's unfortunate because we don't have a whole lot of commercial property to develop, and that's a tough development site the way that it's laid out like that. It's a tough get.
Well, and I don't think there's a whole lot we'd want to see out there.
Which
really.
Is part of the issue. I mean, that property, one, is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
And has those hills on it. The views on top of those hills are absolutely amazing because I've been on top of them. And the one thing that would be good that would be great to get is if it did develop is if we could get dedication for public open space and trails, because if you could get access up there, to be phenomenal, because again, the views from there are just unimaginable. If you haven't seen it, it's panoramic. It's beautiful. So, again, I feel fortunate to have been out there a couple of different times and looked at it. So, it's loud out there. Got permission from the owner.
License to trespass.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
The area around that then is open space. Is that
some of it's open space and some of it's agriculture. So they can graze.
Those big green, light green areas.
Yeah, the darker green areas are open space, and then the lighter green area that surrounds the whole thing is agriculture.
Open space. I was just having trouble with the colors. So, okay, that's ag.
Yeah.
So that open space, is that open to the public?
It identifies areas that were they to develop that we could likely require dedication so we could get access. Mm-hmm. There's a recreation component to the one piece of the open space.
So, again, I'm really ignorant of zoning law. So it was originally zoned agricultural at some time way in the past, and then it somehow turned into residential, and then it was downzoned to commercial. Is that what happened?
I don't know. I don't know the particulars of it. I mean, because it's back in the 80s. I don't know if the package for the whole approval included land use changes or if the land use had been changed prior to that in some effort by the city. I don't know the answer to that. I've not seen documentation that told the story. I just know what it ended up being after the vote was taken. Ended up being that.
But it's a fair guess that any effort to downzone it further back into agricultural land of some sort would be resisted as a taking a property?
I'm sure that they would try to fight it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they own a lot of land out there beyond the city boundary as well.
Somebody recently posted the whole history of this on Nextdoor.
Oh, did they?
And with all of the different ordinances and things. So I will email that to both of you.
That'd be great. Yeah, I'd love to see it.
It was
really
interesting.
Yeah. I've only seen, you know, the stuff immediately around when the vote was taken, a couple of the articles that were in the paper. That's all I've seen from it. Yeah. That'd be great. I appreciate that. That type of stuff's kind of fascinating. Anything else? Yes. Yes. It's all one APN. I don't know if it's all one lot, but it's one assessor parcel number. The little boundaries there are boundaries that were drawn on it as part of the referendum. They don't actually represent lots. Again, which is interesting.
All right. Anything else? I think we're going to get done early. We hit all of that. Committee member closing comments? Anything? No? And Michael Baker's not here. How about you, Scott? Anything?
Sure. I mean, I did touch on it before. I don't know. You know, I don't have another. Against we're not adjourning to another meeting because I don't have one scheduled or teed up for GPAC for anything for the GPAC to review. Part of that's going to be looking at timelines as it relates to the Planning Commission getting through things and whether we have sufficient time to bring things back to GPAC. Meetings could look like a joint meeting of some sort, maybe when we get further down the road. I could see us, you know, if nothing else, you know, keeping the group together until we went through the certification process, so that the GPAC could weigh in on changes that come back from Coastal. That would be valuable, I think. So that would be well down the road, so you'd be hanging out for a while not having any meetings. But for sure, I would imagine we're going to get changes back, and I think it would be an appropriate thing to take those changes back through the body. You know, in an ideal world, I would love to bring everything as it's redone and put back together before this board, but I don't know from a timing standpoint that we have the ability to do that, and we have to be cognizant of that because we have real deadlines. And so I would apologize a little bit for that, but I mean, it takes as long as it takes. Kind of, it's not like we've been sitting back. I mean, it's just been reviewing the material consistently once we got the documents put out there, and again, it kind of takes as long as it takes. So if we have opportunities or ability to do it, I'll look to that. If I don't, then I will let you know that as well. But as things change and become a little clearer moving forward, I will certainly send out update emails to you all to let you know where we stand.
Anything else? Sounds good. Good luck. Crack the whip. And I'm certainly willing to hang on for as long as it takes to come back and discuss things.
Great.
I would imagine most of us are.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, great. I would, like I said, if nothing else, we'd like to be able to, as we go through the certification process, be able to bring that back through once we get comments, because I think having the perspective that you have, having walked through this entire process, is one, amazing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information that we gave you, and two, just you know this better than anybody else in looking through it, and you're the ones that we filtered all of this through. So, I mean, it would be good to get your take on things later. So,
thank you. You guys have done a great job.
Yeah, thank you all. Couldn't have done it without you. not that messy. You guys did a really good job. You were. Yeah, well, I mean, it's that way in my head a little bit, too, so don't feel bad.
And all over my living room.
Yeah, this is my office at my house is 90% of it is general plan stuff, because I do a lot. It's hard for me during the day-to-day operations of the department to look at any of this stuff. So I look at most of it when I'm at home, and it's just you know, stacked, piled up notes everywhere, you know, all over it. So at some point I'll get to take all that stuff down and put it in a box.
There you go.
So. Yeah.
That's true. Phones are off.
Yeah.
All right. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Yeah.